You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about a search and recovery effort to find a downed World War II plane that brought a team from UW-Madison to northern France.
First, yesterday brought another notable Senate hearing for one of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks. Billionaire philanthropist Betsy DeVos has been well known for supporting school choice initiatives around the country.
She's also backed politicians who have supported school choice, like Governor Scott Walker. According to the liberal group One Wisconsin Now, the American Federation for Children, which is the organization DeVos chaired, has spent at least $4.5 million in Wisconsin to elect candidates who back school choice.
Erin Richards joins us now. She's an education reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to the show.
I am glad to be here.
Well, what did Governor Walker say in his letter endorsing Betsy DeVos as the next Secretary of Education?
Governor Walker said that Betsy DeVos is a good choice for this position, that there's a lot of burdensome federal regulations on providing Wisconsin students with the best education possible. And so he looks at Betsy DeVos as someone who can really sort of innovate, create a new and effective system for children. Walker was part of two letters. He has one individually that he sent to Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray in Washington. He also signed on to a letter that came from a number of Republican governors around the country that have supported DeVos and wanted the committee chairs to know of their support for her around the country before her confirmation hearing that took place yesterday.
And you've reported some in the past on Betsy DeVos and on the issues related to various kinds of school choice. Can you talk about the role she and her foundation and family have played in funding school choice, pro-school choice candidates here in Wisconsin?
Betsy DeVos wasn't terribly well known outside of education circles and until she was picked by incoming President Trump to lead the education department. But her family has played a really critical role in the growth of private school choice initiatives around the country. In Michigan, where her family has been based, there has been a lot of activity around charter schools. And in particular, both she and her husband have been active in Republican politics for a long time. There's been quite a bit of resistance to regulation on schools that operate outside of the conventional system. And then specifically in Wisconsin, the American Federation for Children is sort of the heavyweight national philanthropy that's been very thoughtful in how they invest in political races around the country that really serve to get pro-choice, pro-school choice candidates into office. So that means candidates that support charter schools and private voucher schools. Get those people into office so that you can really move legislation at the state level that creates more of those opportunities for school choice initiatives at the state level. And that's certainly happened in Wisconsin, and coupled with their support for Scott Walker, it's really allowed school choice to expand in this state.
And you've written, I think it was in one of your pieces that I read, that some years back, that money was balanced out by political money from the teachers union here in Wisconsin after the Act 10 changes hindered the work of those unions, to put it mildly. There isn't that countervailing force anymore. Is that right?
We're just not seeing the same amount of money and energy and strategizing from the left that we've seen on the right in recent years, especially since the 2010 midterm elections is really when a lot of conservatives kind of figured out innovative ways to move the needle at the state level. And especially in Wisconsin, I mean, this is part of why Scott Walker is held up as such a hero in conservative circles, that by passing legislation that helped to restrict union activity, you were able to really, with conservative funding and the energy behind moving the needle there, you were able to make more gains than if you'd had, the teachers union heavyweights putting the same amount of money into elections and lobbying as they've been able to do in past years before Act 10.
Talking to Erin Richards from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos and her role in Wisconsin politics in the past. Is there a sense, Erin, that Betsy DeVos and her foundation have made a difference in Wisconsin politics, gotten more Republicans elected, more pro-school choice candidates elected?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they have They've been, you know, in previous years when there was less attention on the American Federation for Children, they were very explicit in their annual reports where they reported to, reported publicly that this is where we invested this amount of money. These were the races where we, were able to block a Democratic, sort of public schools advocate from either staying in office or getting into office, and instead we got pro-choice people into office. You look back at their reports, their, legislative impact reports from 2012, 2013, even 2011, and there's much more explicitly saying this is where we really had an impact, and that's important to their donors. In the most recent year, I noticed in 2015, you really don't see a dollar figure at all about how much they spent and what races directly were a win for them because of that. But they've been pretty explicit about, still having the money may not be as publicly disclosed as it used to be, but they've still been, quite forthright in the fact that these are elections that they've won by nature of getting pro-choice people into office.
The basic argument about school choice, if you're in favor, you say, hey, parents should be able to make more choices. Having charter and voucher options give better educational opportunities for kids, especially in places where education is struggling. You'll get better outcomes for kids. On the other side, people say, no, it doesn't, and you're taking resources away from public schools that need them. This is a huge question. A lot of people have tried to research this. Do we know, do various school choice programs improve educational outcomes for kids?
It depends on who you talk to, and it depends on what study you're looking at. So overall, the research that we know from Milwaukee is that overall test score outcomes are about the same between the public schools and the privately funded voucher schools. Now, if you're talking about charter schools, which are public schools, they have to be accountable. They have to respond to records requests just like public schools, but they have some more freedom from some of the regulations that govern conventional schools. In some parts of the country, in urban areas, charter schools are outperforming their public school counterparts. Some of that research comes out of Stanford. It's probably the best research on charter schools around the country. There is some research in the Milwaukee area and some beyond that being exposed to a voucher in a private school can help kids actually eventually graduate from high school, maybe have an impact on lowering incarceration rates. But a lot of that is countered by folks on the left and in public schools that say, well, listen, we understand this, but we don't know the full extent to which schools on the front side of things can say, you'd be a good fit for our private school, or maybe we don't have a space for you, or maybe we can't serve your needs very well. Those questions are just really hard to answer in research. And a lot of the folks that run voucher schools say, hey, we're in the urban area because we want to serve needy kids. We're not picking and choosing. But that belief, still persists on the left that there is some difference in some of the types of kids that some of these schools are serving. And really, it comes down to a resource question, too. Are you supporting your teachers? Are there the same number of resources and availability of educational and extracurricular resources for kids in, private voucher schools as there are in the public school system?
All in all, does having Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education, as the leading voice in education at the federal level, make a difference for what happens here in Wisconsin?
I think it certainly sets the tone for where the country is going when it comes to how we think about serving our schools. So in the confirmation hearing yesterday, there was not a real commitment on behalf of DeVos, and a bunch of critics brought this up, making sure that all kids were served by the federal disability rights law. That gets trickier in private schools, which are not beholden to the same federal law for serving kids with disabilities as public schools are. You have a strong signal from Trump that there's interest in trying to figure out how to spend a lot of federal money on choice options, whether that's charter or voucher programs. Probably would be likely to be charter programs. We know that Betsy DeVos is interested in that as well. And I think that if the person at the top of the command chain for our public schools in America is interested in those types of initiatives, those are just going to get more discussion and a lot more attention than they've ever gotten before under people who were a little bit less inclined toward those options outside of the conventional public school system.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Erin Richards, education reporter and editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about Governor Walker's endorsement of Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education under President-elect Donald Trump.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
You've probably seen ice skaters, hockey players, and snowmobiles zipping across the ice. But what about motorcycles? Ron Davis takes us inside the ice racing scene.
In January and February, weekends in Wisconsin are often a problem for me. I can only watch rehashes of the last NFL season, clean my basement, or binge watch old seasons of 24 so many times before I have to get out and do something. My knees are shot, so skiing would put me in a wheelchair. And snowshoeing, while I can appreciate the aesthetic attraction, it combines two of my least favorite activities, sweat-soaking labor and moving at a glacial speed. And I will forever be mystified over why someone would want to spend an afternoon doing something called curling. So I was basically up for anything when I heard about a motorcycle race on ice. The Central Wisconsin Ice Racing Association schedules races for motorcycles and quads just about every weekend in January and February all over Wisconsin. I chose to head for one on Partridge Lake near Fremont. Despite a biting wind and sleet that crackled on the hood of my parka, the lake was packed with trucks, heated trailers, motorcycles, four-wheelers, and lively clusters of friends, families, and racers clad in snowmobile suits and high-vis racing gear. Brats were being grilled, hot coffee and cocoa were being poured. It was a party. Jim Falke, president of the CWIRA, kindly began my initiation to the sport by showing me the bikes and introducing me to a few racers. I was immediately struck by the wicked-looking carbide studs sprouting from the bike tires like ragged claws. One rider, Mark Muth from Black River Falls, who's been ice racing for 40 years, showed me scars crisscrossing the top of one hand. The studs had chewed through his glove and all the way to the bone as he tipped in front of another racer's front wheel. Now, all bikes wear special fenders that shield their wheels to prevent most injuries. Racers also use all the safety gear they'd wear in the summer, usually more because of the cold conditions and unforgiving surface. After a short rules meeting with the riders, bikes in the first heat edged up to a long bungee stretched across the starting line. With little delay, the bungee dropped and the bikes blasted off onto a plowed half-mile track that offered hairpin right and left-handers and straightaways where riders hit speeds of more than 80 miles an hour. I didn't see any riders go down all day, and some told me they felt that ice racing is actually less dangerous than summer motocross or enduro, since ice tracks are level and traction is even throughout. Riders in elbow-to-elbow packs as tight as any I've seen at Road America created little blizzards of ice shards as they tilted their bikes at scary angles through the turns, 1 foot stretched out to skim the track. The air was filled with the sound of redlined four-strokes and cheers from fans and families. It didn't seem to matter to most who won or lost, though. I had the feeling the enthusiasm for motorcycle ice racing has less to do with purses and trophies and more to do with shaking a triumphant fist in the face of 4 or 5 months of short gray days, life-threatening wind chills, and hours spent toiling behind a snow shovel. Yep, winters can be tough here, but there's something I find heartening in the ways we come up with to defy it.
Ron Davis is a writer and professor at UW-Stevens Point. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, last summer, a team of people from UW-Madison worked with the U.S. Department of Defense to search for the wreckage of a World War II plane that was shot down in May of 1944 in northern France.
Leslie Eisenberg joins us now. She's an archaeologist and forensic anthropologist. She's an honorary fellow in the UW-Madison Anthropology Department. Leslie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, take us up in the air that day in May of 1944. What happened?
Well, on May 27th, 1944, a young 22-year-old first lieutenant by the name of Frank Fizikas was coming back from a sortie or a mission whose goal was to try and keep the Germans back from northern France. And after his sortie, his aircraft, a P-47 Thunderbolt, was struck by what we believe was German fire. The pilot, first lieutenant, did not bail out of the plane. He didn't radio for help. His wingman noticed that the plane lost altitude, went into a spin, avoided some wires, some electrical wires, and crashed in a farm field in northern France in a village called Bousqueur.
And after that, it seems like it was kind of a mystery what happened. The plane was not found. The remains were not recovered. Why not?
Well, there are many pieces to this story, not the least of which were the villagers in the town, the village where the plane crashed, and more notably was the neighbor who witnessed the crash in 1944, who at the time was a 12-year-old boy playing in his family garden, which was across a narrow road from where the plane went down. And because that area was occupied by the Germans at the time, the Germans wouldn't let any of the villagers get close to the crash site. And initially, the crash site was burning very heavily. The Germans partially filled in the crater that was caused by the crash. And over time, the landowner filled in the field so it could be used for agriculture again.
Okay, so the huge question for me is, 7 decades later, how do you even start trying to find this?
Well, there wasn't a lot of information except for the fact in 2012, a federal agency whose mission is to do the fullest possible accounting for lost service members, not only from World War II, but from many other conflicts, sent a front team out, including anthropologists, military historians, to re-question the witness and to try and determine if they could locate the crash site. You know, initially in 1947, the government did send out a team, but because of the fact that the technology just wasn't there at the time, they deemed the body non-recoverable. So we have the government going back in 2012. We have a team in 2015 go out. UW staff, and they questioned the witness again. UW hired a firm that uses a geophysical technique called ground-penetrating radar to see if they could locate any signal of something in the field where the witness believed the plane went down.
And you are part of the team that was there more recently that had more success. Again, it was a near miss because the witness apparently was a kid and didn't remember things exactly the way they are now. But tell us about how you did end up at the right site.
Well, at what I call the 11th hour, we didn't know if we were going or not going until about 2 weeks before we boarded the plane in O'Hare. At the last minute, an unclassified map from World War II that depicted an aerial view taken by the Brits 2 days after this particular crash site came to light. And you can see in the corner of a field, almost outside of the aerial photo itself, you could see what looked like an area that could represent the crash site. So on that basis, we went over with a permit from the French government, and as a public-private partnership. This is the first time Department of Defense ever partnered with an academic institution to look for that crash based on basically the field scar visible in the 1944 aerial photo.
So now you've got the site and you were able to recover the plane and the remains of the pilot, is that right?
Well, we had a team made up of UW students, UW student veterans, associate director from the biotech lab, someone from the med school, myself, and a Belgian historian and researcher. And we, at about 3 meters down, which is almost 9 feet, we started recovering larger pieces of what could be an aircraft. The excavation has not been completed. My colleague also, Dr. Bill Belcher, came in to assist with the excavation at the tail end. And so we know we found the crash location. It's pretty circumscribed, which means to us that the plane came in almost nose down. And so we are planning to go back in a couple of months to recover what we hope are the pilot's remains. And we're not so interested in the plane parts, but we do want to recover the pilot's remains for his son, who grew up to be an Air Force pilot and who joined us on site for a period of time this summer.
I know. Very moving. Yeah, that part was an amazing story. I wish we had even more time to tell it. And we just have a couple seconds left, Leslie. What can people do if they would like to support efforts like this?
Well, everyone, if they're interested, can go to our Facebook page, which is UW Missing in Action. And you can also support our efforts for this particular recovery and future recoveries by donating either as a corporate sponsor or an individual sponsor, and we would be most grateful for that.
Leslie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Leslie Eisenberg, an archaeologist and forensic anthropologist, talking about the recovery of a downed World War II plane thanks to a group from UW-Madison. This is Central Time.
This Friday, Donald Trump will be sworn in as the President of the United States of America. While supporters are excited for the big day and the beginning of undivided Republican-controlled government, Trump's set to begin his new role with record-setting low approval ratings.
Most presidents have a honeymoon period with more shows of bipartisanship and general goodwill, but questions remain about how long or short a Trump honeymoon might be.
The Trump camp says do polls still matter given their failure to predict this year's election? We'll look at that question now and who is and isn't attending Inauguration Day. Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy has this to say about Inauguration Day boycotts by Democrats in Congress.
That's bad for the country. Show up, be part of it. Put your big boy pants on and let's start working together.
Paul Nolet joins us now. He's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, Paul, I want to start with Donald Trump's approval ratings heading into Inauguration Day. Where are they right now?
Well, right now they're about at 40% to maybe 45%. And just to put that in historical context, it's considerably lower than what most president-elects have at this point, just prior to their inauguration. For example, President Obama, when he was still president-elect a few days before his inauguration, had approval ratings that actually got close to about 80%. And even George W. Bush, who, of course, came into office after a very contested election, one that was ultimately settled by the Supreme Court, at this point in his just prior to the inauguration, was in the 60s for his approval rating. So Trump is quite a bit lower than that.
Are there any presidents that come to mind that went in with a lower approval rating, lower than 40?
No, not coming into office. If you look at Trump's approval ratings right now, they're a lot more reminiscent of maybe, you know, a president who's been in office for a few years. So it's not unusual, say, even for President Obama to have approval ratings come down to 40% or so at some point during the presidency. But to see it that low at the start of a presidency is really, at least in the history of polling, which started right around the time of FDR in the middle of the 20th century. I mean, ever since then, this is really kind of an unprecedented how low the approval ratings are for Trump coming into office.
Now, in terms of approval ratings, presidents have taken them pretty seriously historically, and it's something that may be changing now. We're working out what happens next, but looking at why they've mattered in the past, how would you explain that?
Well, a lot of times presidents may say, oh, you know, I don't pay any attention to the polls, and I just do what's right and that sort of thing. But really, I think inevitably presidents do pay attention to the general trend of polls. And I think part of it is because inevitably that's going to have an effect on how other important institutions of government interact with the president. So if, say, Trump's approval ratings really start to shoot up, for whatever reason, in the first months of his term, then I think that's going to give a lot more confidence to Congress, both the House and the Senate, to kind of go along with what Trump wants in his first 100 days. But if his approval ratings stay where they are and even go down potentially, that's going to scare off a lot of senators and representatives who might be a lot more skeptical to go along with what Trump has to say.
Now, most presidents can expect a honeymoon period of cooperation, maybe increased goodwill, bipartisanship on Capitol Hill when they first enter office, those first period of days or weeks and months there. What do you expect for Donald Trump?
I think it's going to be quite a bit different. And I think the inauguration boycott that's been organized by, it looks like, about 50 or maybe even over 50 Democratic politicians at this point seems to indicate that it's going to be a pretty hard landing, I think, for Trump coming into office. And that's in many ways different than what previous presidents have seen, even recent presidents. So one thing that I think is easy to forget when you think about the Obama presidency, which, of course, has been very contentious in many ways, very polarizing over the last 8 years between Republicans and Democrats. Nevertheless, when he came into office, I alluded to before, he had high approval ratings. There was a lot of good feelings that were expressed, at least in polls, by not just Democrats, but Republicans and independents as well. But what we're seeing now is Democrats, even before Trump enters office, saying, I don't know if we can work with this person, with this new president, and we just don't trust him to do the right thing. And like I mentioned before, for that to happen during the course of a presidency is not unusual, but that for it to happen right at the start is in fact pretty unusual.
On the other hand, you know, Democrats are in the minority, so if it comes to a honeymoon period, I mean, couldn't that mean that the honeymoon might last about 4 years?
It's possible. In this case, I don't even know if I would characterize it as a honeymoon period, because when you think of sort of a honeymoon period in the context of a presidency, it is a situation in which members of both parties tend to say, oh, yeah, I'm willing to work across the aisle and let's give the new president a chance and let's see what we can get done. But there hasn't been a whole lot of that rhetoric right at the start. It's been much more contentious. But that's exactly right. One of the big advantages that Trump has is that both houses of Congress are firmly under Republican control. And so that's going to make it certainly easier than if we had divided government. It's going to make it easier for Trump to get a number of his priorities through Congress. But nevertheless, as I mentioned before, if Trump's approval ratings stay where they are or even decline, it's going to make it a lot harder for some members, particularly vulnerable members in Congress, to stick with Trump and to stick with somebody that, say, Trump goes into the 30s for an approval rating. You're going to see a lot of them say, you know what, I'm going to worry more about my own election than kind of march in step with Donald Trump.
Paul Mollett is with us right now from Marquette University, and we're talking about what it looks like in the lead up to Inauguration Day for Donald Trump. And looking ahead past Inauguration Day, what can we expect in those first 100 days or so?
It's going to be quite interesting because Trump has promised a lot of things. Even on day one, a number of things he said he was going to do. And so what I would expect is a number of policy changes right off the bat. So one thing that was, I think, pretty apparent with the Obama administration is that after, especially those first 2 years of his presidency, where he had a friendly Congress, democratically controlled Congress, after he had a much more difficult time trying to get legislation through Congress, he turned much more to executive orders and executive actions to get policy made. So that was true in immigration. It was true with climate change and other environmental programs. And I think because of that, because Obama went in that direction, maybe out of necessity, it will in some ways be easier for Trump to reverse those, certainly within the first 100 days, and maybe perhaps even on day one, or at least in the first few days, by issuing his own executive orders, own executive actions that reverse what Obama did. So one thing that I think is going to be very prominent on a number of issues, big hot-button issues too, like immigration and the environment, you're going to see Trump take pretty strong actions to try to reverse those executive actions that Obama did.
Now, building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border was a priority in the Trump campaign. Do you see that as being something that he could feasibly take action on in 100 days?
I think that's going to be difficult, in part because it's never been exactly clear what he meant by the wall. I mean, there were a lot of adjectives there about a big, beautiful wall that's going to be all around the border. But for instance, where would the funding come from? I mean, President-elect Trump mentioned, well, Mexico is going to pay for the wall. But I mean, Mexico is going to have a lot of resistance to that idea, and getting a negotiated deal where Mexico actually does agree to pay for that wall within 100 days seems, to me anyway, probably pretty unlikely. So if the funding isn't there, then the question is, well, how does a wall happen? How does Trump manage to back up his promises throughout the campaign on that particular issue? So I think at a few points during the campaign, he even mentioned on day one, you know, construction is going to start on the wall, but I think it's going to take quite a bit longer than that.
Paul Millett is with us right now. He's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. And we're talking about the lead up to Inauguration Day for Donald Trump and what to expect in his first 100 days.
And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Looking at Democrats, what do you think of Democratic members of Congress boycotting Inauguration Day? What do you think about the back and forth between President-elect Trump and Congressman John Lewis? And on the Republican side, what are you looking for from the president? And should Republicans in Congress defer to the president-elect when their priorities don't match up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Paul Millett is with us, assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, and we're discussing the lead up to Inauguration Day for Donald Trump coming up this Friday.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Democrats look for ways to cooperate with the president-elect or resist his agenda? What do you make the role of Republicans in Congress? Should they follow the Donald Trump agenda, the Republican agenda we've seen in recent years, or a hybrid of the two? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Let's talk first with Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for giving or letting me talk. I wanted to mention that I hope that with Donald Trump's inauguration, as a conservative, I hope the other side, the Democrats, continue to voice their opposition. I think that the only way that we're going to unify and get together is by having both sides express their views, and by expressing their views, come to some type of consensus. One side doing it all their way is not going to work for anything, and it's just going to continue to cause more problems. We need to go to the middle. Thank you.
Charlie, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. And Paul, do you think there's appetite there? I mean, in a sense, when you've got the numbers game so strong on the Republican side, there's not necessarily a strong necessity to talk across the aisle. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I know one of the big criticisms that Republicans had of President Obama, particularly in those first 2 years when there were big Democratic majorities in Congress, was that he didn't try hard enough to work across the aisle and try to get some Republicans to go along with health care reform, for instance, which was mostly passed along partisan lines. And so I think the big question, and I think Charlie puts his finger on something important here, the question is, will the Republican Congress say, look, we're in the same position that Democrats were in 2009, so we're just going to try to push some things through while we have the numbers, or are they going to try to work across the aisle on some bipartisan solutions? It's tough, though, and it's not entirely clear which direction they're going to go. But the tough part is that really, I mean, one thing that's become quite apparent over the last few years, both, you know, between journalists and scholars looking at all of this, is that the distance between the parties, which we refer to as polarization, the ideological distance between the parties has really grown to levels that really we haven't seen since the 19th century. And so that in many ways makes it harder to work across that aisle and to try to find solutions, especially on big hot button issues like immigration and healthcare. It makes it very difficult to try to find those points of contention. And a lot of times it requires a lot of really kind of back and forth and also some important political entrepreneurship from leaders in Congress and the executive branch as well to make that happen. So we'll see if it happens.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much for that question. And we're going to go next to Scott joining us in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi. I guess I had a comment about Trump getting in there. Once he's in the office there, I think they understand how what he's trying to push across in his policies. I really feel everybody will kind of come together. But this polling thing really kind of bothers me. It takes you back to the campaign when the polling seemed to be going Hillary's way. But you got to really look at, I think it's kind of the same basis that you're trying to say that the approval rating. Well, The polling is kind of like a phone connection. Everything's changed. Everybody's on cell phones, Twitter. The polling thing has to be changed because it's not coming out the way they say. It's not even close.
Scott, thank you for that. Yeah, you're bringing up a point, an interesting point there, one that the Trump camp has made themselves. You know, why should we care about polling? It wasn't right in the general election. And besides, the Trump campaign, Donald Trump seems to operate a little bit independent of polls. And there was a key Republican whose name escapes me now, quoted in the New York Times, Paul, who said that polling was now considered, to him, a false god. So why should we worry if Trump, what should Republicans care if Donald Trump is coming in at a lower approval rating?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the polls themselves go, was it a great year for polling this past year? Definitely not. And polling, I think, is, while a science, it's an inexact science. And and I think Scott mentioned, for instance, you know, the fact that a lot more people have cell phones now and can ignore calls makes it more difficult to conduct polls. I will say, though, that once the final numbers were in and we had all of the election results confirmed across the states, kind of surprisingly, given how it looked those first couple days after the election, the national polls weren't all that off. They were a bit off, but of course, at the end of the day, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote, which is what the polls are measuring, by about 2 percentage points. And the polls had her, you know, maybe more around 3% or something like that at the end of the day. So I would say that the polls, while there's certainly some work that pollsters are going to have to make going forward, they weren't quite as bad as they may have looked in the first couple days after the election. And then as far as the second point goes about why should anyone care about this, I think a big part of that is not necessarily Trump himself caring that he has a 40% approval rating or less than that or more than that, but it has a lot to do with how others react to him. And I think one of the points that I made early on in the program was, especially for those vulnerable Republicans that are in swing districts or even Democratic-leaning districts, it's going to be tough for them as we get closer to the 2018 and then the 2020 elections. It's going to be tough for a lot of them to stick with Trump if Trump's approval rating is really, really poor.
And we leave it there. Paul, thank you for joining us. Paul Nolet, assistant professor at Marquette University.